one sleeps with. He never has. But the men in the black jackets aren't talking about sexuality. Vidar knows that. They're talking about trust and loyalty. Benji has pretended to be something he isn't. He's a fake. He can't be trusted. And Spider and Woody think he's shamed the pack. "We had his back, and all the time he wanted to screw us up the ass," Spider snaps. Vidar says nothing. When he was 12 or 13, just after Spider had fought for him in McDonald's, Vidar asked, "Are we hooligans?" Spider shook his head seriously and replied, "No, we're soldiers. I stand up for you, and you stand up for me. We haven't got anything if we can't trust each other 1,000%. Get it?" Vidar got it. The members of the pack have held together all their lives, and you don't build up that sort of friendship without complex sacrifices. They have different reasons to hate Benji. Some are disgusted, and some feel betrayed. Some are just worried about what opposing fans are going to sing about them now. Some have the bear tattooed on their necks, and how much do you have to love something to do that? So Vidar says nothing. He's just glad to be going home, that everything will be going back to normal. And when Tima leans forward and whispers, "The new coach is holding an open A-team tryout for you. If you're good enough, you'll be allowed to play." Vidar's joy sings so loudly inside his head that there's no room for him to think about anything else. It's only sports. The dogs at the kennels start to bark in the distance as the siblings approach, but Audrey comes out blearily and quiets them down. Leo and Maya stop, alarmed. "Is Jeanette here? Our teacher at school, she's supposed to have a martial arts club. Is it here?" Leo asks. "Club might be a bit optimistic, but she's in the barn." Audrey chuckles and yawns as she scratches her wire wool hair. Leo nods but doesn't move, hands in pockets but staring with interest at the dogs. "What breed are they?" Audrey frowns, looks from Leo to Maya, tries to figure out what they're doing here. Perhaps she realizes, because she too has sisters. So she asks, "Do you like dogs?" Leo nods. "Yes, but Mom and Dad won't let me have one." "Do you want to help me feed them?" Audrey asks. "Yes," Leo exclaims, looking happier than a puppy with two tails. Audrey looks warmly at Maya. "Jeanette's in the barn. You'll find her there." So Maya walks into the barn alone. Jeanette is practicing with a sandbag and stops mid-movement, trying not to look surprised. Maya looks as though she's already regretting her decision to come. Jeanette wipes the sweat from her brow and asks, "So you want to try martial arts?" Maya rubs her palms together. "I don't really know what's involved. My brother kind of dragged me here." "Why?" Jeanette wonders. "Because he's worried I might hurt someone."
"Who?"
Maya cracks as she admits. "Me." "So where do you start?" Jeanette looks at the girl and eventually chooses the easiest option. She sits down on the mat. After an eternity, Maya sits down opposite her, a foot away. Jeanette moves closer. The girl flinches, so she stops. She explains gently, "You'll hear people say that martial arts is violent, but to me it's about love. Trust. Because if you and I are going to practice together, we have to trust each other. Because we borrow each other's bodies." When Jeanette reaches out her hand and touches her, it's the first time since Kevin that Maya has been touched by anyone except Anna without flinching. When Jeanette shows her how to wrestle, how to take a grip, and how to get out of it, Maya has to learn to be held without panicking. On one occasion, she does panic, throws her head back, and hits Jeanette in the face. "It's okay," Jeanette says, not bothered by the blood on her lip and chin. Maya looks at the clock on the wall. They've been wrestling for an hour, free from thought, and she's sweating so much that if her eyes are streaming, she doesn't even know it herself. "I'm so fucking terrified sometimes that it's never going to be okay," she pants. Jeanette doesn't know how to reply, either as a teacher or as a human being, So she says the only thing she can think to say as a coach. Are you tired? No. Then let's go again. Maya doesn't heal inside that barn. She doesn't build a time machine. She doesn't change the past. She isn't blessed with memory loss. But she will come back here every day and learn martial arts. And one day soon, she will be standing in the line at the supermarket when a stranger accidentally brushes past her. And she won't flinch. It's the greatest of all small events, and no one understands. But she will walk home from the store that day as if she were on her way somewhere. That evening, she will come back to train some more. And the next day. It's only sports. Anna is sitting high up in a tree not far from the kennels. She sees Maya and Leo walk home through the forest. She's been following them. She doesn't know why, just wants to be close to Maya somehow. Everything feels far too cold without her. They're only a few feet apart when Maya passes beneath her on the ground. Anna could have called something, climbed down and begged and pleaded with her best friend to forgive her. But this isn't that sort of story. So Anna sits where she is, high above, and watches her friend walk off. The next day, Vidar takes the bus to school. Plenty of people know who he is, so no one dares to sit next to him. Not until a girl a few years younger gets on at a stop on the outskirts of the Heights. She has scruffy hair and sad eyes, and her name is Anna. The first thing Vidar notices is how beautiful her ankles are, as if they weren't meant for floors, but for running through forests and over rocks. The first thing Anna notices is Vidar's black hair, so thin that it hangs over the skin of his face like raindrops on a window pane. In many years' time, we might say this was a story about violence. But that won't be true, at least not entirely. It's also a love story. Chapter 35. But only if you are the best. There's going to be a press conference in Beartown. It's the worst possible timing for some people, when the whole town feels like it's on its way toward imploding from 100 different conflicts. But of course, it's the best possible timing for other people. Richard Tiu, for instance. The representatives of the factory's new owners fly in from London. The local paper photographs them cheerfully shaking hands with the Spanish homeowning politician in front of the factory. Peter Anderson stands dutifully alongside. His voice is unsteady and his eyes are fixed on the tarmac, but he promises to get to grips with hooliganism. The Spanish homeowning politician is so proud that his shirt is practically bursting. He starts the press conference by mentioning his esteemed and modest colleague, Richard Tiu. He deserves our thanks for his great service to the district. Without Richard's contacts and hard work over the course of several months, this deal couldn't have been concluded. The Spanish homeowning politician goes on to describe, rather less modestly, his own involvement in the deal. Taxpayers will benefit enormously, he explains. And the most important thing, jobs in Beartown have been saved. When the female politician at his side suddenly opens her mouth, the Spanish homeowning politician is so taken aback that he doesn't have time to react at first. She says, "And not just in Beartown, of course. In collaboration with the factory's new owners, we have reached an agreement in which the workforce in Hied will also be prioritized. That's one of the conditions. If the council is to support the factory financially, the entire council district needs to benefit." The journalists take notes and photographs, film the press conference. The Spanish homeowning politician stares at the woman, and she meets his gaze. He's powerless, because what can he say? That he's not thinking of giving Hied any jobs? He'll be facing elections soon. He's shaking with rage, and his smile for the cameras is strained, but when he's asked about the jobs, he is forced to say, "Any responsible policy obviously has to involve the whole district." He is standing slightly hunched as he says this, whereas the female politician feels herself grow several inches taller. Early one morning in a few months' time, An envelope will be lying on the step outside her front door, and the documents inside will show how the Spanish homeowning politician has been involved in undeclared property speculation in Spain. It will admittedly turn out that the Spanish homeowning politician is entirely innocent, but Richard Tew doesn't need evidence, just doubt. The headlines about dodgy deals will be big. The notification of his innocence will be confined to a few modest lines on the back pages of the local paper. The Spanish homeowning politician's political career will already be over by then, after his party colleagues agree unanimously that the party can't afford any scandals. He will be replaced by a female colleague who appears to have plenty of enemies in Beartown, but even more friends in Hied. Benji doesn't turn up for practices with the team. He doesn't call. He doesn't answer when anyone calls him. But late one evening, when most of the lights in the rink are out and the locker rooms are empty, he is standing alone on the ice wearing jeans and skates with a stick in his hand. He's come here to shoot some pucks, the way he's done a million times before, and to see if it still feels the same, if it can be the way it used to be. But his gaze has been caught by the image of the bear in the center circle. Someone glides out onto the ice and stops beside him. Elizabeth Zakel. "Are you going to play in the game against Hied?" she asks with a complete lack of sentiment. Benji swallows hesitantly, still staring at the bear. "I don't want to be a problem for the team. I don't want them to feel that..." "That's not what I asked. Are you playing or not?" Zakel asks. Benji closes his eyes quickly, opens them slowly. "I don't want to be a burden to the club. Are you planning to have sex with anyone in the locker room?" "What the... what?" Zakel shrugs. "That's what people think, isn't it? That gays have a problem with discipline? If everyone starts having sex with each other in the locker room?" Benji frowns. "Where the hell have you heard that? Are you planning to have sex with anyone in the locker room or not?" "Like hell." Zakel shrugs again. "So you're not a burden. Hockey is hockey. People can say what they like about you outside the rink, but in here it doesn't matter. If you're good, you're good. If you score goals, you score goals." Benji doesn't look convinced. "People hate me. You as well. Maybe it's just too much for them that you and I are both... you know, maybe they could live with one, but two in the same team, that's too much for people." Zakel sounds taken aback. "What do you mean?" Benji's eyebrows twitch. "That you're gay." "I'm not gay," Zakel replies. Benji stares at her. "Everyone thinks you are." "People think a lot of things. They're far too obsessed with their emotions." Benji just gawps at her for a long time. Then he starts to laugh. He can't help it. "Seriously, Zakel, you must see that everything would have been a hell of a lot easier for you in this town if you just told everyone that you're not... like you."
"Yes."
Zakel snorts. "I don't think you have any obligation to tell everyone who you want to have sex with, Benjamin. I don't think I have either." Benji scrapes the side of his skate against the ice. He thinks for a while before he asks, "Do you ever wish you were a man?"
"Why would I?"
Zakel wonders. Benji looks at the bear on the ice, tries to find the right words.
"So you didn't have to be a female hockey coach."
Zakel shakes her head slowly, but for once she doesn't look entirely unmoved.
"My dad probably wished I was a boy sometimes."
"Why?"
"Because he knew I'd always have to be twice as good as the men to be accepted."
"The same thing applies to you now. You'll be judged differently. The people who hate me might let me coach a team, but only if we win. And they'll let you play, but only if you're the best. Just being good isn't enough for you anymore."
"It's fucking unfair," Benji whispers.
"Unfairness is a far more natural state in the world than fairness," Zakel says.
"Did your dad tell you that?"
"My mom." Benji swallows hard.
"I don't know if I can be captain."
"Okay," Zakel replies. Then she turns and leaves him without any more words.
as if any more were needed. Benji is left standing alone at the center circle. Eventually, he fetches a stack of pucks from the boards, drops them onto the ice one after the other, for possibly the last time. This sport is never happy being just part of you. You have to sacrifice too much. There are too many things you know only if you've spent your whole life in here. How much your feet hurt when you skate for the first time after the summer. How unbelievably bad your gloves smell at the end of the season. The sound when you slam into the boards or fire a puck into the glass. How every rink has its own unique echo. How every stride sings when the stands are empty. How it feels to just play. How your heart beats. Bang, 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 bang. The first morning, Anna sits next to Vidar. Neither of them says anything. Anna is too weighed down by guilt and loss to speak. For the entirety of her childhood, she has always gone to school with Maya, and the loneliness is a shock. She's sleeping a lot, because she's hoping she might wake up and realize that the mistake of her life was a dream. It never happens. But the second morning, she sits next to Vidar again, and just as the bus is approaching the school, she glances at him. He pretends to be busy with his phone, but she sees him looking. He's the sort who can't help it. "What are you playing?" she asks. "What?" he mumbles, as if he's only just noticed her. She's not that easily fooled. "You heard." He starts to laugh. He does that when he's nervous. He will soon discover that when Anna gets nervous, she makes sarcastic jokes instead. If they spend their whole lives together, they might become the least suitable couple to encounter at a funeral. One who can't stop making jokes and one who can't stop giggling. "Minecraft. I'm playing Minecraft," he says. "Are you 7 or something?" Anna wonders. He laughs. "It helps me to not... I have trouble with my impulse control. My psychologist says Minecraft is good. I can concentrate better when I just play." The bus stops. The students spill out. Anna doesn't look away from him. "You're Tima Renius's little brother, aren't you? You were the one who was in prison?" Vidar shrugs. "It was more like a holiday camp." "What do you mean about not being able to concentrate? Have you got some sort of syndrome or something?"
"I don't know."
Anna smiles. "You're just an ordinary nutter, then?" Vidar laughs. "Some people say I'm a psychopath. You shouldn't be talking to me." Anna looks him carefully up and down. His black hair is draped around his eyes.
"You look too kind to be a psychopath," she says.
He frowns. "Watch out. I might have a knife." She giggles. "If you had a knife, I wouldn't be scared of you, even if I was a loaf of bread." Vidar falls head over heels for her, because he's the type who doesn't know how to stop himself. Chapter 36. Don't psychopaths go for walks, then? Elizabeth Zakel holds her open tryout early one morning. A handful of players show up, a few juniors who haven't got anywhere else to play because Beartown didn't manage to put together a team for them this year, and some older players who have been let go by other clubs and are out of a contract. None of them is anywhere near good enough to get onto Zakel's team, but that doesn't matter. They're only there as extras, so that the club can say it was an open session. Vidar is the only player of interest, but Zakel has to go and look for him when he doesn't appear on the ice. She finds him in the equipment storage room.
"Can I help you?" she asks.
"Have you got a saw?" Vidar asks.
"What for?" Zakel wonders.
Vidar holds up his goalie stick. "This is too long." During all those nights he was locked in the unit and played with Baloo, Vidar needed to be able to fire the balls and pucks back to the other side of the basement after he'd saved Baloo's shots. He couldn't wear skates in the basement, so he sawed the top off his stick to make it the right length. He accidentally sawed off too much and it ended up too short, but he discovered that that meant he could make harder passes, and more accurately, too. The only thing you have an excess of when you're locked up is time, so Vidar started to experiment with different lengths and types of tape on his stick. He ended up taping it without leaving a lump at the end, the way most goalies do, which made his grip better. Zakel finds him a saw without understanding what he's doing, but when Vidar is happy with his stick and goes out onto the ice, he stops the puck and fires it without any effort, sending it from one end of the ice to the other. "Can you do that again?" Zakel asks. Vidar nods. Zakel puts him in front of one net and goes and stands by the other one. "Pass to me," she calls. So he does. Right across the whole rink, right to the blade of her stick. It might not sound like a big thing if you're not bothered about hockey, but Zakel knows that most goalies in Beartown's league couldn't get a puck to hit water even if they fell out of a boat. "This guy will be our goalie when we haven't got the puck, but an extra player when we have," she thinks. And she can win that way. "Get in goal," she commands. He obeys. She starts firing puck after puck, and she's a good shot, but he saves everything. She lets the other players in the open session have a go, but not one of them manages to score. She gets two of them to shoot at the same time, then three from different angles. Vidar pretty much doesn't let anything past. His reflexes are remarkable. Zakel looks around the stands. At the top, over in one corner, sits Peter Anderson. As far away as it's possible to get on the other side, in the standing area, is Tima Renius. Spider and Woody are standing next to him. Tima tries to hide how proud he is, but fails. Spider and Woody don't even try. Zakel turns to Vidar and calls, "Take a break and have a drink." The other players stop shooting. Vidar takes off his helmet. His sweaty black hair is stuck to his face. He turns his back on Zakel and lifts his water bottle. So she takes aim and fires a slap shot that hits him hard right in the back. Vidar jumps and turns around, and Zakel immediately fires another shot that whistles past his unprotected head just a foot away. Tima yells, "No!" from the stands, but Vidar doesn't hesitate. He's already set off towards Zakel at full speed. No one on the ice has time to realize what's happening, so if Tima hadn't known his brother so well, Zakel might not have got out of the rink alive. Vidar throws himself at her, taking wild swings with his gloved hands, and Tima sets off from the stands, wrenches open the door to the bench, and leaps over the boards. His boots slip on the ice, but he manages to grab hold of his brother and uses all his strength to wrestle him onto the ice and pin him down. Spider and Woody are a few steps behind, and it takes all three of them to stop Vidar from getting up and beating Zakel to death. "Are you completely insane?" Tima yells at her, but the female coach isn't remotely frightened and is grinning from ear to ear. "Can you promise that he'll show up for practices on time and he'll play every game?" Vidar is still struggling frantically to pull free of his friend's iron grip. Tima glares at Zakel. "You could have killed him. You could have died. He could have killed you." Zakel nods delightedly. "Exactly. Vidar doesn't give a damn about me being a woman. He was going to kill me anyway, wasn't he? To him, I'm just a hockey coach. Can you promise that he'll show up on time to each practice?" Tima peers at her. She's obviously crazy. "You mean he's got a place on the team?" Zakel snorts. "A place on the team? I'm building the whole team around him. I'm going to make him a professional." Tima swallows hard and replies tersely, "Okay. I promise he'll show up on time for practice." Zakel nods and leaves the ice at once. She's done here. The other players at the open session will merely receive a short message telling them that they're not good enough for her team. She's honest, fair, and unsparing. Just like the sport. Out on the ice, Vidar eventually calms down. He lies on his back, sweaty and exhausted. Tima sits down next to him. Vidar turns to him skeptically and mutters, "What the hell, bro? Are you crying?" "I'm not fucking crying," Tima snarls, and turns his face away. "You look like you're..." "Back off," Tima yells, and hits Vidar's arm so hard that his little brother curls up whimpering on the ice, while Tima gets to his feet and walks out of the rink. Elizabeth Zakel bounces into Peter Anderson's office. "Did you see the tryout?" she blurts out. "Yes,"
Peter says. Can he play? Zakal asks.
Can you control him?
Peter asks.
No, that's the whole point, Zakal says jubilantly.
She looks happy. It gives Peter a headache. Outside in the parking lot, there's an old Saab. Tima comes out of the rink, lights a cigarette, walks alone toward the car, gets into the passenger seat, and closes the door behind him. When he's sure no one is watching, he leans his head on the dashboard and closes his eyes.
He's not crying.
Back off. The next morning, Anna sits next to Vidar on the bus again. He's playing Minecraft, because he has to concentrate so he doesn't get too nervous to dare ask her,
I'm going to be playing on the Beartown A-team. Do you want to come and watch?
Anna sounds suspicious.
I didn't know you played hockey. I thought you were a hooligan, like the others in the pack.
She says the pack without fear. No one else in this town does. Vidar's counter question is shy, almost hurt.
Don't you like hooligans?
She snorts.
I don't like hockey players.
He laughs. She's pretty good at making him laugh. But before the bus stops at the school, he says seriously, the pack aren't hooligans.
What are they then? Anna asks.
Brothers. Every one of them is my brother. They stand up for me and I stand up for them. She doesn't judge him for that. Who wouldn't want to have brothers? Maya is driven to school by her mom. Kira doesn't ask why Anna doesn't go with her anymore. She's too happy that Maya lets her drive her all the way to school without feeling embarrassed. Just 6 months ago, her daughter always asked to be let out a few hundred yards away so she could walk the last bit herself. But now Kira is allowed to drive all the way to the bus stop, and her daughter leans over the seat, kisses her on the cheek, and says,
Thanks. See you later.
Those words are far too insignificant to topple a grown woman. But they mean the world if you're someone's mom. Kira drives away on a cloud. Maya, on the other hand, walks into school alone. She fetches her books alone, sits in classes alone, eats lunch alone. It's her choice, because if she can't trust her best friend, who can she trust? Anna walks into the school not far behind Maya. It causes a very particular sort of chill to have to see your best friend every day and know that she's no longer that. They used to part with a secret handshake that they came up with when they were children. Fist up, fist down, palm, palm, butterfly, bent fingers, pistols, jazz hands, mini rocket, explosion, ass to ass, out bitches. Anna came up with the descriptions. At the end, after they banged their backsides together, she always threw her hands into the air and yelled, And Anna is out, bitches! Now Maya walks into school without even noticing that Anna is behind her. Anna hates herself, perhaps more for what she has done to Maya than for what she did to Benji, so this is her final act of love, to make herself invisible. Maya disappears into the corridor. Anna stands motionless, broken. But Vidar reaches out his hand. Are you okay? Anna looks at him. There's something about him that makes her answer honestly, so she replies, No. He runs his fingers manically through his hair and mumbles, Do you want to get out of here? Anna smiles sadly.
Where?
Vidar shrugs.
Dunno.
Anna looks around in the corridor. She hates it. Hates herself here. So she asks, Do you want to go for a walk?
A walk?
Vidar repeats, as though it's a foreign word.
Don't psychopaths go for walks, then?
Anna wonders. He laughs. They leave the school and walk side by side through the forest for hours, and that's where Anna falls for him, for all his clumsy, jerky, nervous gestures. He falls for her because she's invincible and brittle at the same time, as if she were made of both eggshell and iron. He tries to kiss her because he can't stop himself, and she kisses him back.
If they had lived their whole lives with each other, they would have become something remarkable together. The headline in the local paper after the press conference reads, "New jobs, but half earmarked for workers from Hied." The article includes numerous quotes from politicians. Most are shocked when the reporter demands a response and try to give neutral answers to avoid provoking either side. The only one who deviates from that line is, of course, Richard Tiu. He manages to make his statement sound spontaneous, even though he's prepared it in minute detail. "What do I think about the factory's quotas? I don't like any form of quota. I think that Beartown jobs should go to Beartown workers." It's hardly soaring oratory, but it travels fast. Within hours, the slogan, "Beartown jobs for Beartown workers," is being repeated not only online, but in bars and around dinner tables. The next morning, there is a note on the hood of the Spanish homeowning politician's car. To stop the note blowing away, the person delivering it has pinned it down with an axe. Notes can blow away so easily, otherwise, when the wind changes direction. Immediately after the press conference, Peter starts calling builders. They all answer. They are all available for work, until he tells them what the job is: demolishing the standing area in the arena. Suddenly, some of them have no time after all, while others say they're not qualified to do that. Some just hang up. Some spell it out in plain language. "We've got families, for God's sake, Peter." At one of the firms Peter calls, the phone is answered by a voice identifying itself as Woody. When Peter explains why he's calling, Woody laughs loudly and derisively. Later that day, Kira finds a cardboard moving box outside the Anderson family home. Most people who opened it would have thought it was empty, but she knows better. She tips it slowly onto its side and hears the little metal cylinder roll across the bottom. She sees it glint in the light reflected from her children's bedroom windows. A rifle cartridge. Chapter 37. What We Are Capable Of. Most of us don't know what terrible things we are capable of. How can we, until someone pushes us far enough? Who has any idea how dangerous we can be until someone threatens our family? Kira is standing hidden in the shadows. She's followed Tima from the supermarket. He's carrying a bag of groceries in each hand, one mostly full of cigarettes. He goes into the bearskin. When he comes out again, he's alone, and the street is empty. Kira doesn't know what sort of demons take possession of her, but she suddenly finds the nerve to march forward. "Tima Renius," she snarls, sounding more threatening than she feels. He turns around. "Yes?" Kira walks up to him so close that she can feel his breath. She's holding a folded moving box. A window opens above the bearskin, and an old woman peers out, but Kira is too agitated to notice. "Do you know who I am?" Kira asks. Tima nods, his face 5 inches from hers. "You're Peter Anderson's wife." Her head moves back, just a fraction, but her voice grows louder. "I'm Leo Anderson and Maya Anderson's mother, and I'm a lawyer. So maybe I am afraid of you, just like everyone else, but you need to get one thing very clear. If you come after my family again, I'll come after your family." She throws the box on the ground between them. Tima raises an eyebrow. "Are you threatening me?" Kira nods. "You can be damn sure I am, Tima Renius. And you can tell all the cowardly little lowlifes in your little pack that next time they leave a rifle cartridge on my drive, I'll put it in your head." Tima doesn't answer, and his eyes aren't giving a thing away. Perhaps Kira should have been satisfied with that, but she's past the point where that's even possible. So she takes something out of her bag. Empty pill bottles. She holds them up mockingly in front of him. "You lot came to my family's home, so I went over to yours, Tima. This was in your mom's garbage bin. Classified medication. Does your mom have a prescription for drugs like this? Because if not, she's breaking the law. And above all, her supplier is breaking the law. And that's you, isn't it, Tima? What do you think will happen when I come after you?
Tima blinks slowly, evidently fascinated. But when he takes a step toward Kira, she backs away. Because everyone does. His words are an order. Go away. Now.
Kira lowers her head involuntarily. She'll end up cursing herself many times for doing this, but we don't know what we're capable of until someone pushes us far enough. She leaves the street, trying not to break into a run as she heads back to her car, and almost succeeds. Up at the kennels, Audrey is feeding her dogs. There are no cars with their trunks full of drink coming today. There won't be any hunters calling in for coffee either. She doesn't know if it's because they don't want to or because they don't dare. It's never easy around here to know if people want to say something and are just not saying it, or if they're not saying anything because they don't know what to say. So Audrey calls her friend Jeanette, who's still at school catching up on her grading. Throughout their childhood, it was always Jeanette who called Audrey and asked if she wanted to play, never the other way around. But now Audrey asks, "Do you want to come over and train?" Jeanette goes at once. They lift weights and beat the punching bag until they can no longer lift their arms. Jeanette doesn't tell Audrey that everything is going to be all right, because she doesn't have a little brother and doesn't know if it ever will be all right. But she trains and trains for as long as Audrey wants to continue, and when the road remains empty, with no sign of cars or hunters, Jeanette can't help thinking that may be just as well. She can see in Audrey's eyes that if anyone shows up here and says the wrong thing about her brother, that person will have to be carried out. Tima is still standing outside the bearskin, and the window on the first floor is still open. Ramona's voice carries down to him. "Rumor has it that you left a black jacket for Leo Anderson in school, Tima. But you gave Leo's dad a rifle cartridge. Where's the logic in that?" Tima sounds sure of himself, because he has a little brother he shares only the same mother with. Maybe we recognize that men don't have to become the bastards their fathers were. It's an excuse. Ramona is well aware of that as she stubs her cigarette out on the window ledge. "If it was you who left that cartridge, then I don't actually know what to think about you." Tima interrupts her in a tone that he never uses with anyone else, apologetic and shamefaced. "It wasn't me, but I can't control every..." Ramona interrupts him in turn, and her voice is anything but affectionate. "Don't try that on me. You may not control everything your boys do, but you know damn well that none of them would do anything if you'd expressly forbidden it." Tima begins, but Ramona cuts him off. "You and I don't judge each other, Tima. We never have. But children are the only people who don't have to take responsibility for anyone but themselves. The rest of us have to take responsibility for the things we cause to happen. You're a leader. People follow you. So frankly, if you can't take responsibility for the actions of your followers, that makes you nothing but a monster." Kira never mentions the rifle cartridge to Peter or the children, or anyone else for that matter. But when she gets back to the house, two of the neighbors, an old woman and an even older man, are sitting on tatty folding chairs in their driveway, wearing green t-shirts. Their front door is open. The light is on in the hall. Kira can see the old man's hunting rifle leaning against the wall inside. He's old and slow, and perhaps the rifle isn't even loaded, but it doesn't matter. The old woman nods to Kira and says, "Go in and get some sleep, Kira. We thought we'd just sit here and watch the cars go by for a bit." The old man opens a thermos flask and mutters, "There are rumors that a few moving companies have been given the wrong information and have been going to wrong addresses recently. That's not going to happen around here again." Small words, a small gesture, but that's all it takes to say that we live here too, and nobody messes with us. Tima is standing thoughtfully outside the ice rink. Beartown is dark, and the only window still lit up is in Peter's office. What will a person do for his club? For his town? Who does it belong to? Who do you allow to live in it? Eventually, Tima calls Spider and asks, "Who left the moving box outside Peter's house?" Spider clears his throat in surprise. "You don't usually want to know who does what. You usually, what is it you always say? I'll let you know when you've gone too far." It's true. That's the pack's way of protecting Tima. No one can ever hold him responsible for something he knows nothing about in any court case. He says, "You went too far. Don't do it again." Spider's stubble scrapes against the phone. "It wasn't us. It was some youngsters, the kids in the standing area. Damn it, Tima, you know how everyone feels. The kids hear their dads talking about all the jobs going to Hied, and then they hear us talking about Peter ripping out the standing area. They're just trying to impress you. They thought you'd be pleased." Tima covers his eyes with his hand and lets out a deep sigh. "Don't be too hard on them. Just make sure it doesn't happen again." Spider clears his throat again. "The business with the moving box, or anything aimed at the family?" Tima's voice gets sharper. "We don't attack people in the club. We'll stand tall once those bastards have gone, and we're standing tall now, but we don't attack people in the club." "What about the standing area, then?" Tima admits for the first time. "I've had a meeting with a politician, a friend. He's going to give us back our standing area. And we're going to be standing long after Peter Anderson has left this town." When darkness falls, Benji is sitting on the outhouse roof out at the kennels. He stubs out his cigarette and makes a decision, at last. Then he walks alone through Beartown. He doesn't hide in the shadows. He walks in the middle of the glow from the street lamps. He hasn't been going to school. Hardly anyone has seen him since they found out that he was gay. But now here he is, walking along out in the open. Perhaps it's stupid, but sooner or later he has to confront everyone. This is too small a town to have many hiding places, and where would he go? What do you do when you just want everything to be the same as normal? You go to work. You hope for the best. When he walks into the bearskin, the bar falls silent. A stranger might not have noticed, might have thought the chat and arguments and clink of glasses were the same as usual. But every cell in Benji's body hears the oxygen being sucked out of the room. He stands still. The very fact that he's come here might seem crazy, but he was never the sort of child who lay in bed afraid of ghosts and monsters. He'd rather open all the doors, upturn all the mattresses, tell them to come and get him straight away if they were going to do it anyway. Sooner that than just waiting. A group of men at a table toward the back of the bearskin stand up. First one, then all of them. Black jackets. None of them finishes his beer. Their glasses are left demonstratively half full. Everyone moves out of the way as they walk toward the door, but none of the men touches Benji. They just stalk past. Out, away. Within 2 minutes, a dozen more, old and young, some in black jackets, some without, some in hunting jackets, some in white shirts, have done the same thing. Feelings are complicated. Actions are simple. Vidar is one of the people sitting at the table at the back of the bar. When he was younger, he asked Spider why he hated queers so much. Spider replied without a trace of hesitation, "Because it's disgusting. Men are men and women are women, and that's just some bullshit made-up sex in between. There's research, you know. They're missing something in their brains, some substance. And you know who else hasn't got it? Pedophiles and people who screw animals and that sort of shit. It's a disease, Vidar. They're not like us." Vidar didn't believe that at the time. He doesn't believe it now. But when Spider and Tima and the others stand up and walk out, Vidar does the same. Because since he was little, he's learned that soldiers stick together. He doesn't have to hate Benji, He just needs to love his brothers. Which is both complicated and not complicated at all. Long after closing time, Ramona and Benji are still sitting in the bar, just the two of them. People have so much crap in their heads, it might not even be about you, Ramona says tentatively, but she knows the boy knows she's lying. They left their beer. They don't want to drink with people like me, Benji whispers. His words are dry twigs, snapping under the slightest weight. Ramona sighs. It's a lot all to take in at once, Benjamin. A female coach, those damn politicians, sponsors getting involved in how the clubs run. It's making people nervous. Everything's changing. They don't hate you, they're just... People just need a bit of time to digest things. They do hate me, Benji corrects. Ramona scratches her chin with the whiskey glass. Tima and the boys saw you as one of them, Benjamin. That's what's making it worse. Some of them may have thought, I don't know, they might have thought stuff like this only happened on television. That men like that, well, that they only lived in the big cities and, you know, dressed in a particular way. They've lived their whole lives assuming it was something you could tell about a person at first glance. But you were like them. They drank with you. You fought together. They yelled your name in the rink. You were a symbol. You proved that one of them could lead this team, this town, when they felt that every other bastard was out to get them. You were the middle finger they stuck up at the world. You were the bandit who proved they didn't have to adapt, that they could win anyway, that those of us out here in the forest could take on anyone who wanted to have a go at us. I never asked anyone to give a damn. I just want everything to be the same as normal. Ramona grabs hold of Benji's head hard with both hands until his ears feel like they're going to fall off. Then she yells, "You've got nothing to apologize for, boy. You hear me? Nothing. I'm not defending any of the men who walked out of that door tonight. I'm just saying the world turns quickly. Don't judge us too hard when we, well, just don't judge us too damn hard. Everything's changing at such a speed that some of us can't always keep up. We sit here and hear about quotas for all sorts of things, and it's easy to wonder when it's going to be our turn. When do we get a turn? I'm not defending anyone, boy. I'm just saying that some people around here feel they're being attacked from all sides, that everyone's telling them their way of life is wrong. No one likes having change forced upon them. I'm not forcing anyone to do a damn thing. I just want things to be normal. Ramona lets go of him, sighs, pours more whiskey. I know, boy. It is what it is. We're just going to have to find a new normal, that's all. There are two types of people now. Some of them need more time, and some need more sense. There's no hope for the second group, but we might have to wait to see how many there are in the first group before we start beating it into their heads. Benji is avoiding eye contact. Are you disappointed in me, too? Ramona starts to laugh, coughing up smoke. Me? Because you want to sleep with men? You sweet boy, I've always been very fond of you. I wish you a happy life. So I can only lament the fact that you want to sleep with men, because one thing I can tell you here and now is that it's impossible to be happy with men. They're nothing but a load of damn trouble. Chapter 38. The Game. There's going to be an ice hockey game. Beartown Ice Hockey against Tied Hockey. The rest of the country is barely aware that it's taking place. No one cares except for here. But here, everyone cares. Some people can't understand things unless they've experienced them for themselves. The overwhelming majority of the world's population will live their whole lives in the belief that a hockey game is just a hockey game. That it's just a silly game. That it doesn't mean anything. They're in a fortunate position. They don't have to go through all this.
What would you do for your family? What wouldn't you do?
Hogg has never had any business cards, but if he did, there would be four things on it. Hockey player, car mechanic, father of three, Aunt Katrine's husband. She still sings in his head. She still dances on his feet. He's never going to let her stop. He finishes work in the garage just like on a normal day, even though things will never be normal again. When he goes into the house, Bobo, his eldest, is washing the dishes. It was Bobo who went to the undertaker's and organized the funeral and cremation. Then he came to grips with everything else. There's food on the table. The younger kids are already eating, and Bobo has done the laundry. Everything his mom used to do. Hogg gulps hard when he sits down at the table so that the younger children won't see him shatter. Then he says to Bobo, "You should go and play in the game." Bobo whispers, "I'm needed here. I've still got washing and..."
"Harry Potter,"
his little brother says, even though his sister hushes him.
"Yes, I'll read some Harry Potter tonight, like I always do,"
Bobo promises, blinking as he stares down at the washing-up bowl. Hogg chews, directing his own blinking at his plate.
"This is good. Really good."
"Thanks," Bobo whispers. They say no more until the younger children have gone to brush their teeth. Then Hogg gets up, washes his plate, and hugs Bobo as he whispers an order in his ear.
"I can read that damn Barry Trotter tonight. It's about time I learned how to. You hear what I'm saying?"
Bobo nods silently. Hogg holds his cheeks and says,
"You and I are going to get through this, because Mom will never forgive us otherwise. So go and play your game now, because Mom will be watching from wherever she is. Not even God or the angels or whatever else there may be could stop her watching her eldest son's first game on the Beartown A-team."
Bobo packs his bag. When he walks out of the door, Hogg expects the other children to beg and plead to be allowed to go too. But they don't. Instead, they stand on the steps with their hockey sticks and a tennis ball and ask, "Do you want to play, Dad?" So Hogg watches his eldest son go off to his first A-team game, and then he plays hockey with his two younger children in the garage. They struggle and sweat and chase the ball for hours, as if it were the only thing that mattered. Because it is, at that moment. And that's the whole point. What would you do for your family? Peter Anderson goes from room to room in the house before he sets out from home. Kira is sitting in the kitchen with her laptop and a glass of wine.
"Do you want to come to the game?" he asks without much hope.
"I need to work," she replies predictably. They look into each other's eyes. At least they do that. He moves on and knocks on the door to Maya's room.
I'm going to the game now," he whispers.
"I have to study, Dad. Good luck,"
she calls from the other side of the door. Mother and daughter say that because it makes things easier for him. They're giving him a chance to pretend that everything's fine. He knocks on Leo's door too, but Leo isn't home. He's already gone to Hied. He's planning to watch the game from the standing area. Peter knows he should stop him, punish his son. But how do you do that when all you've ever done is nag your son to go to hockey games with you? Anna is standing in front of the mirror trying to choose an outfit. She has no idea how she ought to look. She's been to 1,000 hockey games, but never one where Vidar has been playing. It's a stupid fantasy, but she wants him to turn toward the stands and catch sight of her, and realize that she's there for his sake. Her dad is stumbling about in the kitchen downstairs. He knocks something over, then something else. She hears him swear. It aches so deeply in her, all his drinking. She throws on some clothes without picking them as carefully as she planned, because she wants to be out of the house before her dad gets so drunk that he needs help. She doesn't want to let the bad version of him steal this game from her. Not today. He calls out to her when she reaches the door, and her first thought is to pretend she hasn't heard him, but something in his voice brings her up short. It's too clear, too steady. It's unusual.
She turns around. Her dad has showered and combed his hair and is wearing a clean shirt. The kitchen behind him has been tidied up. There are bottles in the recycling bin, and he's tipped their contents down the sink.
Have a good time at the game. Do you need any money? He asks tentatively.
She looks at her good dad for a long time. The bad one seems so far away right now.
How are you feeling? She whispers.
I want to try again, he whispers back.
He's said that before. It doesn't stop her believing him. She hesitates for just a moment, then says, Do you feel like going for a walk?
Aren't you going to the game?
I'd rather go for a walk with you, Dad. So that's what they do. While two whole towns head to a hockey game, a father and his daughter go for a walk in the forest that has always been theirs. Him, her, and the trees. A family.
Bobo cycles through Beartown carrying an invisible backpack of stone. He arrives late at the pickup spot, but no one seems to care, and Zekel hardly seems to notice that he's turned up. Amit sits next to Bobo on the team bus to Hied, but doesn't know what to say. So they say nothing. The parking lot in front of Hied's ice rink is full of people, and there are lines even though there's still a long time before the game starts. The rink is going to be full, the towns are in an uproar, the hate has had plenty of time to grow. This is going to be war. The bus is silent. All the players are wrestling with their own demons. Only when the 18 members have gotten off the bus and gone into the hall, along the corridor, and into the locker room and are all sitting down, does one of the older players get to his feet. He walks over to Bobo with a roll of tape in his hand. What was your mom's name? The older player asks. Bobo looks up in surprise, swallows hard.
My mom? Aunt Katrine. Her name was... Aunt Katrine.
With a K or a C? The older player asks.
K, Bobo whispers.
The older player writes Aunt Katrine on a strip of tape. He sticks it onto the sleeve of Bobo's jersey. Then he repeats the process and fastens the tape onto his own sleeve. The roll of tape passes silently around the locker room. Bobo's mom's name is on every arm. Amit skates out onto the ice. As he's done throughout his childhood, he starts skating around, around, around to warm up. Normally, he doesn't hear anything. He's gotten good at that, no matter how many people are in the rink. Everything becomes background noise, and he disappears into a zone of concentration that makes whoever is at the other end of the boards irrelevant. But today is different. Something breaks through the noise and yelling. His name. A few people somewhere are chanting it. Louder and louder, over and over again, until Amit looks up. Then the cheering gets louder. In one corner, right at the top, stands a group of idiots jumping on their seats. They're not there to cheer for either of the teams, they're there for one single player, because he's from the Hollow. They're singing the simplest, most beautiful, most important thing.
Amit! One of us! Amit! One of us! Amit! One of us!
Fatima arrives at the rink in Hied on her own, but she's holding two tickets. She watches the game with an empty seat beside her, on Katrine's. When Amit comes out onto the ice, she stands up and cheers, and when Bobo comes out, she cheers twice as loudly. She'll do that at every game Bobo plays, and every game his younger siblings play. No matter where their lives take them, there'll always be a crazy woman in the stands cheering loud enough for two. Why does anyone love team sports? Because we want to be part of a group? For some people, the answer is simply that a team is a family. For anyone who needs an extra one, or never had one in the first place. Vidar Renius loved playing hockey when he was a child, just like every other kid. But unlike all the other kids, he loved the stands even more.
He always promised himself that if he ever had to choose, he'd never pick the ice over the standing area. He said that to Timo when he was little, and Timo smiled and